Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, February 27th, 2017. A bishop in Yei says soldiers raided a church compound, leaving one person dead.
What disturbed us really very much was our houses in the headquarters were really destroyed. And we have a house which is built in the metallic and the windows all with glasses and all these were broken.
And South Sudanese students in the diaspora say change is possible in their country.
I think we sometimes think of change as something that is radical, something that transforms society in a way that's unimaginable. But change happens on a very small level. And so if we each take the responsibility individually to contribute to society and to contribute to resolving the conflict in South Sudan, then we can actually achieve something.
We'll have these stories and more coming up in South Sudan in Focus. A bishop in Yei River State says government forces killed one person and looted property at the church compound on Friday. Bishop Seme Nigo of Panyana Diocese says soldiers stole computers and other items. Yei River State Governor David Lokonga Moses says he has not received any information about an attack. SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Lul Roy Kwong says the same, but adds the army is investigating the matter. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
The incident comes a week after church leaders accused government forces of blocking roads, making it nearly impossible for civilians to seek refuge in camps in northern Uganda's Koboko district. Bishop Seme Nigo, who fled Panyana to Koboko during previous fighting, says church members still in Panyana informed him that soldiers arrived from a nearby garrison and went on a rampage, killing one person and looting church properties. He says he doesn't know why security forces, who are supposed to protect citizens, resorted to killing and stealing from the church.
What disturbed us really very much was our houses in the headquarters were really destroyed. And we have a house which is built in the metallic and the windows all with glasses and all these were broken. The doors were broken and everything inside were carried out. And those ones which are available to them, they were taken. And one person was found, one person was dead. He was killed by the same people.
Bishop Seme says the unidentified person killed was a Christian inside the compound at the time of the attack. Panyana Diocese is a headquarters of more than 10 parishes in Yei River State's Lujulo County. Bishop Seme says, beside computers, soldiers looted beds, mattresses, and anything of value from the church compound. He says many residents fled to the borders of the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, while others fled into the bush with no access to humanitarian services. Bishop Seme is urging humanitarian agencies to provide relief aid to the many displaced civilians.
The quick emergency kind of thing, if it could be really delivered to our people, would help. Because now some of us are in the border and they are unable even to come to the camps in Uganda. There's nothing which can facilitate them to come to Uganda. And if there could be something to support them near the border there, I think it could be of great help.
State Governor Lokonga disputes the allegation that soldiers carried out the attack on the church.
You know, sometimes there are some individuals who are tempted to come and loot, and this one is always labeled against the army. Secondly, they are armed group and they operate as they want.
Lokonga says government forces are trying their best to maintain security in the area.
The commanders are now conducting series of rallies and meetings with the old army commanders and all the NCOs, telling them that this time we are in a mood of dialogue. Dialogue is a solution to anything. And I think we want to embrace this. People are yawning. People are crying. They want to come back. They need peace.
SPLA spokesman Brigadier Lul Roy Kwong says he has not received any report of looting either, but vows that the army leadership will investigate the matter if it receives a report about an attack. For VOA News, I am Tiro Justin in Juba.
UN spokesman Stephane Dujarric told reporters late last week at UN headquarters in New York that uniformed South Sudanese soldiers attempted to abduct internally displaced people near a UN protection of civilians site in Bentiu last Thursday.
Soldiers were seen beating and harassing 11 internally displaced people at a nearby farm. UN peacekeepers intervened and rescued 7 women and 4 men. In other related incidents that same evening, peacekeepers also prevented the harassment of other people who were returning to the protection of civilian site.
David Shearer, the head of UNMISS, praised members of the Mongolian battalion for intervening and rescuing the civilians. According to Dujarric, Bentiu is the largest POC site in South Sudan. The camp hosts more than 120,000 displaced people inside the country. UN Human Rights Chief Saeed Raad Al Hussein warns world peace and stability based on fundamental human rights are under threat by so-called reckless political profiteers. The High Commissioner issued his stark warning at the opening of the 34th session of the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Lisa Schlein has this report for VOA.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayed Raad Al Hussein warns many of the achievements made in stabilizing the world order since the end of World War II are at risk of being lost by growing populism. He says durable peace in many parts of the world and success in development over the 7 decades following this shattering war are due to the observance of the fundamental human rights enshrined in the UN Charter and other international human rights treaties. He says the world has a lot to lose by heeding the ill-gotten campaigns being waged by political leaders against universal human rights or by their threats to withdraw from the treaties and institutions supporting these rights.
To those political actors who, as in the days of the League, threaten the multilateral system or intend to withdraw from parts of it, the sirens of historical experience ought to ring clear. We will not sit idly by, for we have so much to lose, so much to protect, and our rights, the rights of others, the very future of our planet, cannot, must not be thrown aside by these reckless political profiteers.
Antonio Guterres is attending his first session of the UN Human Rights Council as UN Secretary General. He expresses alarm at what he sees as a spreading disregard for human rights around the world.
We are increasingly seeing the perverse phenomenon of populism and extremism feeding off each other in a frenzy of growing racism, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim hatred, and other forms of intolerance. Minorities, indigenous communities, and others face discriminations and abuse across the world. And the same applies to members of the LGBTI community.
Guterres warns violations of human rights are early and leading indicators of crisis. He says it is up to everyone to make prevention a priority. He says root causes of conflict must be tackled and human rights concerns addressed earlier and more effectively. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The ongoing fighting in South Sudan has dominated headlines on and off around the world for years. Diplomats, politicians, and activists have all worked to change the course of violence in the young country, but economic, political, and humanitarian conditions have only gotten worse. Some college students here in the Washington, D.C. area say changing the trajectory in South Sudan is possible, but policymakers must pursue a different approach. Graduate student Sandra Tombe describes herself as an ambitious and hardworking South Sudanese student. The 25-year-old is working on a doctoral degree at George Mason University in conflict resolution, which she hopes to use to help people in her native country. Although hopeful, Tombe says she is not naive and is aware that achieving long-term change in South Sudan could take some time.
That's the thing. I think we sometimes think of change as something that is radical, something that transforms society in a way that's unimaginable. But change happens on a very small level. And so if we each take the responsibility individually to contribute to society and to contribute to resolving the conflict in South Sudan, then we can actually achieve something. And we're not going to see that change over, night, but it's something that on a daily basis, we have to be working on it.
23-year-old American University student Lu Jingjiang agrees, but says that policymakers and diplomats have so far taken the wrong approach to helping the people in South Sudan. He told VOA the international community should focus more on building the country's infrastructure to create an atmosphere where democratic ideals and civic engagement can flourish.
I'm a realist. So again, I think human rights and the political campaign, they're important. But I think what's more important is how many schools you have, how many hospitals you have, right? How many South Sudanese can be benefited from that so that they can make money, they can have family, they can let their children go to school. So in the end, you look at the big picture.
But for other students like Dao Dol Dol, a rising South Sudanese American junior at the School of International Studies at American University, the conflict is much more personal. And he says for countless young people like him, who once called Kenya's large Kakuma refugee camp home, all he has ever known is war.
Most of the youth, most South Sudanese youth, were born in the refugee camp, were born during the war, were displaced during the war. So all we have known our whole life, I'm 21 years old, and all I have known is war. Now, how do we change that? We have to change the cycle of warrior-like mentality that we have in South Sudan, and we're torn our own house apart. So we have to change something. Something has to change. There are absolutely no words to describe it because we were so full of joy. We were so full of hope.
Tombe agrees.
The fact that some people are impacted, that means all of us are impacted, and that we have a role each to play in that as students and as people who are hoping to kind of step into leadership roles. And so it's something that we need to take on now and build into it into the future, and not something that we assume, you know, after we finish school, for example, or after we get a real job, but it's something that we're incrementally building upon.
As we reported, UN agencies declared famine in parts of South Sudan last week, and aid workers say delivering life-saving aid to displaced communities has proven extremely difficult due to poor security conditions. The South Sudan government plans to initiate a national dialogue next month, which President Salva Kiir says is aimed at ending hostilities and bringing together divided communities to resolve their deep-seated differences. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Japan makes a donation to the government to help South Sudanese produce locally grown foods. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today...
What do you like most about your African culture?
First of all, our celebration, it is unique. So the second one, I like the way we look for our clothes. Yeah, the way we live.
The thing I like about African culture is, first of all, the fact that it is unique. You see, African culture is unique. The second thing is that Africans like their culture, which is different from the Western people and so on.
When you see the way African lives, it is more different from the continent. So the way African lives, I like so much. The way they dress too. African, the way dresses is very nice. Have a good look.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The Japanese government has donated $500,000 to South Sudan's Ministry of Trade and Industry, which the ministry says will be used to start processing locally produced foods so that South Sudan can become more self-reliant. Nabil Biagio has more for VOA from Juba.
The ministry says the money will help export honey, gum arabic, and other locally produced food items. It's part of Japan's $22.4 million donation to South Sudan for humanitarian aid and reconstruction announced earlier this year. Kiya Masahiko is the Japanese ambassador in Juba. He says Japan will be working with the Ministries of Trade and Agriculture to improve the quality of the food produced in South Sudan.
I look forward to working together with the ministry and the minister so that our support in this field of quality assurance and agribusiness would bring about tangible benefit of the people in this country.
Moses Thiel, South Sudan's Minister of Trade and Industry, says with Japan's help, South Sudan will soon be able to produce locally grown food.
The ministry, together with our donors, Japan particularly, we are working very hard to make sure that the agricultural products in Southern Sudan are processed here and value addition is also made here in South Sudan.
Despite three UN agencies declaring famine in parts of South Sudan just last week, Thiel says the country should be able to meet its own food needs.
For example, we are getting things like vegetables and tomatoes from Uganda. We shouldn't be doing that. You know, we have water here, the land is here. The only thing which is missing is to encourage our small businessmen, our small farmers, to do that kind of work. They say that they can grow tomatoes here, they can grow okra here.
The UN, the US, and others in the international community have said the famine in South Sudan is man-made, as fighting continues between the two warring parties, despite several ceasefires signed and the 2015 peace deal signed by the political leaders of both sides. Juba resident Lodo Festo is grateful for Japan's donation, but says he hopes the government will put the money to its intended use.
Our problem is actually in implementation. You know, things can be done like this, but now to put things in practical, sometimes it may not be possible.
Festo says it is more important now for donors to devote their money to the emergency humanitarian needs of people who are starving.
They have been announcing a famine in other areas, so I feel that that money will have been given to those areas so that they rescue those civilians who are actually suffering in those areas.
For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
As thousands of South Sudanese continue to stream across the border into Uganda and resettle their families in the capital, Kampala, because of the ongoing violence and deteriorating economic conditions, many South Sudanese say they face enormous challenges searching for houses to rent, as well as retaining these houses. Simon Peter Apiku reports for VOA from Kampala.
After the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005 and again after the country's independence in 2011, most South Sudanese had no problem finding houses to rent in Kampala. Many came with cash in hand and rarely haggled over the price of rent. But that's all changed since the conflict broke out in late 2013. South Sudanese now struggle to make ends meet in Kampala. Transplanted South Sudanese Daniel Agwek says Ugandan landlords still expect South Sudanese to live up to their previous reputation of being prepared to pay full rent despite the fighting and economic and political chaos at home. Agwek even accuses Ugandan landlords of deliberately hiking rental fees for prospective South Sudanese tenants.
When they know that South Sudanese are here, sometimes they say that these people, they are money, they will overcharge. These are the things which we are facing here.
Florence Tito is a South Sudanese widow and mother of three who raises her rent money in Kampala by selling bread and cakes. She says most Ugandan landlords believe South Sudanese still have the sort of money they used to carry around on the streets of Kampala before the civil war erupted.
They think South Sudanese have a lot of money. But this one, it's before, but not now. Right now, we really face a lot of problems. We are suffering.
As a result, Tito says, landlords often demand South Sudanese tenants pay several months' rent in advance.
But other people, they will say they like from this country, 3 months they can pay, 2 months they can pay. But for South Sudanese, especially South Sudanese, 6 months, 1 year, 4 months.
Landlords are also less likely to allow a large South Sudanese family to cohabit a rental unit. Agwek says this often presents a problem for South Sudanese.
Some landlords, they give orders. They will say, I need 6 people, only 6 in number, to be in the house. Sometimes when our visitors come and he has no way there to come and sleep. He may sleep with us. They will say, no, you have become more now. Pay another money.
Abraham Dow, another South Sudanese citizen living in Kampala, says some landlords can be intrusive, demanding, for example, that tenants be out of bed or back at home by a certain time.
Since you have given your house for rent, you must allow that person to feel free and even to make it as his own personal house and to behave according to how it is. Like yesterday, he was been commanding these young brothers of mine.
Agwek says since most South Sudanese in Kampala have little money to spare for rent, they are normally forced to comply with what most see as unreasonable demands of landlords.
If we are refusing and arguing to them, they may say, okay, you go out and look another house. And for looking for a house here, it's very difficult. You can't even move for 1 year.
However, Dow says some landlords are sympathetic and even tolerate late payment from South Sudanese.
In 2015, we spent about 5 months without paying any single coin. And after our money were came, we gave him to him, you know.
A majority of South Sudanese living in Kampala rely on remittances from their relatives in South Sudan. But such payments have been drying up due to economic hardships back home, forcing many to move to down-market residential areas on the outskirts of the city and in smaller houses despite the size of their families. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Piku in Kampala.
Doctors in Kenya's public health facilities have refused to work since December. They are demanding the government implement an agreement it signed in 2013 to raise salaries and improve working conditions. But the strike is taking a deadly toll on the nation's poor. Rael Ambor has the story from Nairobi.
Jared Ochieng lost his son Lamak to complications from leukemia.
The strike causes the death of my son. Because if not of that strike, then I could have got the assistance for how to cure my son in our national hospital, which is in the Kenyatta National Hospital.
Lamak was diagnosed with leukemia a year ago. When he started experiencing complications in early February, the family took him to the nearest hospital, Kenyatta National Hospital, one of approximately 2,500 public health institutions affected by the nationwide strike.
When I took my son to Kenyatta National Hospital, cancer department, there were no doctors. So the office that was just operating were the ones that made the arrangements for me to take the son to Texas. There were no doctors who are dealing in that part of leukemia because of the strike.
Texas Cancer Facility is a private facility in Nairobi, but the cost is too high for many Kenyans, making it an option of last resort. Some cancer patients have had no choice but to suspend treatment until public doctors return to work. The Kenya Cancer Association says it's getting reports of 3 deaths a week, a 50% increase compared to this time last year, says Program Director Moses Osani.
The doctor's strike has significantly affected the cancer patients in that most of them have had interrupted treatment. For example, if someone was to go for a cycle of 8 weeks and at the sixth week the doctors went on strike, then their treatment was interrupted, which meant they probably would have to seek treatment elsewhere.
The strike has also affected emergency medical services. Judy Nabwani says her son was hit by a speeding vehicle. She traced him 12 hours later to a country referral hospital where only basic first aid had been administered.
Venye nilifika hospitali, huyo kijana alikuwa amegongwa na gari.
He says he could not move or talk. He was just lying there. A nurse said the doctors were on strike and that the best thing to do was to refer him to a private hospital. He died before he could be moved. Nabwani said her son would not have died if he had been attended to on time. His cause of death was internal bleeding due to brain injury. The striking doctors have refused to resume work. Even after union leaders were arrested, the government has said it does not have the funds to implement the collective bargaining agreement it signed in 2013. Kenya Medical Practitioners and Dentists Union spokesperson Dr. Davis Ombui told VOA the union is pushing for much-needed improvements to the health system.
So far, we actually empathize with the situation. We know many Kenyans are losing their lives. Even us as doctors, we have relatives, we have friends, we have family. And it has affected us both. But the narrative that we were sticking to is that we cannot go back to supervise deaths, as it were.
In addition to raising salaries, the 2013 deal called for the government to hire nearly 5,000 doctors over a four-year period and equip hospitals with the necessary machines and drugs. Hopes are high that negotiations underway will end the strike, but for families of the deceased, it is too late. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And here's a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Ayan. A Yei River State bishop says soldiers killed one person and looted church property on Friday. Bishop Seme Nigo of Panyana Diocese says government soldiers stole computers and other items from the church. Yei River State Governor David Lakonga Moses says he has not received any reports on an attack. SPLA spokesman Brigadier General Roy Kwong says he neither has he, but says the army is investigating the matter nonetheless. The incident comes a week after church leaders accused government forces of blocking roads, making it almost impossible for civilians to seek refuge in northern Uganda. Nigo says he doesn't know why security forces, who are supposed to protect citizens, resorted to killing and stealing from the church. UN spokesman Stephen Dujarric told reporters late last week that uniformed South Sudanese soldiers attempted to abduct internally displaced people near a UN protection of civilian site in Bentiu last Thursday. He says soldiers were seen beating and harassing 11 internally displaced people at a nearby farm. He says UN peacekeepers intervened and rescued 7 women and 4 men and others in a related incident that same evening. And finally, as thousands of South Sudanese continue to stream across the border into Uganda and resettle their families in the capital, Kampala, because of ongoing violence, many say they face enormous challenges searching for houses to rent, as well as retaining the houses they own. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Carol. And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Africa Moto by Moses Sesingo.
Africa, on fête ce soir jusqu'à l'aube. Oh yeah, Africa, on fait la paix par la guerre. Africa, matin, ce soir c'est la cinquantaine. Viva Africa, on va danser, on va chanter, Mama Africa.
We've been listening to Moses Sesingo with the song Africa Moto. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.